thank the organizers for the invitation to present my research here today. And I'm going to talk about stable isotope probing with 18O water to study microbial functions and population dynamics in soil. The outline of my talk is I'd first like to introduce you to labeling DNA of microorganisms with 18O atoms, which were derived from 18O labeled water, which H2 18O being 18O water. Then I'm going to go on and talk about an application of the ability to label DNA with 18O, and that is stable isotope probing with 18O water. And then I'm going to go on and talk about quantification of growth and mortality of microorganisms in soil through 18O water SIP. And finally, I want to talk about an application of 18O water SIP, which is a study of toluene degradation in soil. So in 1966, Richards and Boyer published a paper in a Journal of Molecular Biology in which they show that DNA of growing E. coli culture can be labeled with 18O water. This is the end of an era where they're interested in studying the mechanisms of how DNA replicate in pure cultures of bacteria. Paul Boyer is very interested in how ATP forms, and he will go on and win the Nobel Prize for discoveries on formation of ATP. So in this paper, they talk about 18O labeling of deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA, during synthesis and stability of the label during replication. And this is all work done in pure cultures of E. coli. And what they show in this paper in 1966 is that, one, they can label DNA with 18O from 18O water. And if they then take these cultures that are labeled and they transfer them to 16O water, the 18O label is stable in the DNA, and it dilutes at the same rate as 32P does. So in this graph here, you see on the y-axis here, 32P, part of the phosphodiester backbone of DNA, and you also see 18O atom percent excess on the second y-axis. And what you can see is that 18O dilutes in a similar way that phosphorus does, showing that the 18O label is stable in DNA. And what Richards and Boyer show in their paper is that the oxygen in DNA comes from at least two different sources. So here on the right is a structure of DNA. You see two strands. You see the hydrogen bonding between the complementary base pairs here between cytosine and guanosine and between adenosine and thymidine right here. And then here is the phosphodiester backbone. And the phosphodiester backbone links ribose sugars from different nucleotides together. If you look at the phosphodiester backbone, they found that the bridge oxygen atoms, shown here in red, were derived from water, whereas the C3 and C5 oxygen atoms were derived from glucose. And so the oxygen atoms in DNA can either come from water molecules, or the oxygen atoms can come from glucose. And so the question for me was, is it possible to label DNA in soil with 18O water? And the reason I was very interested in that is that I thought that water would be a great molecule to label microorganisms in soil. And part of the reason is that water is not used as an energy or a nutrient source for microorganisms in soil. There have been quite a few studies of labeling microorganisms in soil with 13C or 14C compounds, and one of the issues there often is that you have a fertilizer effect. You add a slug of glucose to soil, things are going to change. Whereas water would not have those type of impacts. Water is also commonly added to soil in the form of precipitation, so microorganisms are adjusted to getting a slug or getting water added to soil, whereas a slug of glucose might be a very unusual situation for microorganisms in soil. And finally, water can be relatively homogeneously distributed in soil. It is a small molecule. It is not charged. And so I thought it would be a molecule that's easy to add to soil. And so I was very interested to know if it would be possible to label the DNA of microorganisms in soil with 18O water. And it turns out that indeed you can. Here, looking at a graph where on the y-axis, looking at per mil 18O DNA, on the x-axis is time in hours. And so 18O water was added to the soil and at different time points, we extracted the DNA from the soil, and using an isotope ratio mass spectrometer, we measured the delta 18O of the DNA. And you see that there is a linear increase in the delta 18O of DNA over time. And this linear increase has been observed when we use other mechanisms to look at microbial growth in soil. For instance, if you look at tritiated thymidine techniques, we also see a linear increase as the DNA gets labeled over time. So what we think happens is that as new DNA forms, that new DNA becomes labeled with 18O from water, so that this is a proxy for growth of microorganisms in soil. When we added nutrients to soil and we let the soil incubate with 18O water and nutrients for 48 hours, and then we extracted the DNA from soil, we saw a log linear relationship between the delta 18O of DNA in soil and the amount of nutrients that we added to the soil. So here on the y-axis is now log atom percent of 18O DNA. On the x-axis is the log percent TSB. And what you see is there's a linear relationship between the log of the 18O of the DNA and a log of the amount of nutrients that were added to soil, suggesting that 18O DNA, again, is a good proxy for growth. One would expect more growth to occur if more nutrients are added to soil. We did another experiment where we manipulated the amount of water that was present in soil. So again, we incubated soil with 18O water for 48 hours. So then we extracted the DNA and we measured 18O in the DNA that was present. So on the y-axis now is atom percent 18O of DNA. On the x-axis is the soil moisture. And what you can see is that if the soil became wetter, more 18O was incorporated into DNA until the soil got so wet that it starts to decline. And here we are pretty much at full water holding capacity of the soil. And so an interpretation of this data is that as soils become wetter, there's more habitat available, growth increases, until the soils become so wet that both predation as well as limitation of oxygen limits growth and the amount of 18O incorporated in DNA declines. The next question I had is it possible to separate labeled DNA or 18O labeled DNA from non-labeled DNA along a cesium chloride gradient? And so there's a new technique called stabilized stope probing, or SIP for short, and I'll explain more about it in a couple slides, in which labeled DNA is separated from non-labeled DNA along a cesium chloride gradient. And the first test to see if sufficient 18O atoms can be introduced into DNA to separate labeled DNA from non-labeled DNA was done with E. coli cultures. What I did is I grew E. coli in regular water, 16O water. And then in another flask, I grew E. coli in 18O enriched water. I extracted DNA from both E. coli, and then I combined the two fractions of DNA, loaded them onto a cesium chloride gradient, spun the tubes, and saw if I could separate the labeled DNA from the non-labeled DNA. And here are those results. So here in the first ultracentrifuge tube, you see the DNA that was extracted from the E. coli culture grown in regular 16O water. In the middle ultracentrifuge tube, right here, you see a mixture of DNA. So the DNA that was extracted from 16O water culture was mixed with the DNA extracted from an E. coli culture grown in 18O water. And what you can see is that two bands form in this tube. The top band comes from the DNA of E. coli grown in 16O water. The bottom band comes from E. coli grown in 18O water. And similarly, if you decrease the amount of atom percent of the 18O water in which E. coli are grown, the two bands get to be closer together. And so yes, it is possible to separate labeled E. coli DNA from non-labeled E. coli DNA along a cesium chloride gradient. The next question then became, well, can we do this in soil? Is it possible to take a soil sample, incubate it in 18O water, extract the DNA, and separate the labeled 18O DNA from the non-labeled DNA in soil? Or in other words, is it possible to separate the newly formed DNA during an incubation from the DNA that simply survived the incubation? And the answer again is yes, that is possible. So here you see three ultracentrifuge tubes. The tubes that are labeled with A are DNA extracts from soil that have been incubated with 18O water. The tube that's labeled B is from a soil extract in which regular water was added to soil. And what you can see is that two bands form in the soil incubated with 18O water. And our interpretation is that the top band is non-labeled DNA that survived the incubation, and the bottom band is DNA that was formed during the incubation with 18O water. And this band represents newly grown organisms in soil. Interestingly and surprisingly, if we incubated the soil for longer periods of time, then three bands started to form in the tubes. So here you see an ultracentrifuge tube which has DNA extracted from soil incubated with 16O water. And then you see three tubes which show DNA that have been extracted from soil incubated with 18O water for longer periods of time. And you can see that three bands form in these three tubes. One, two, three. So the question is, why would three bands form if you incubate the soil with 18O water for a longer period of time? And I think there are several mechanisms at work, but one of the mechanisms that we liked is the idea that, well, we know from Boyer and Richards that the oxygen atoms in DNA can either come from water or from glucose, the carbon source. And so maybe what happens in soil over extended periods of time is that first you get one band that forms because organisms grow up in 18O water, but they use a non-labeled carbon source. Over time, however, there will be organisms, such as a nematode, which will start to feed on the labeled organisms. And they will then get oxygen atoms, not only from the 18O water in the incubation, but they also will get 18O atoms from the food that they're eating. So that the middle band over here could be bacteria that feed on non-labeled soil organic matter, and they get 18O atoms only from the water. Whereas the bottom band, which forms later, could be from organisms such as a nematode that would feed on labeled bacteria, and they get 18O atoms from both food and from water. And if this interpretation is correct, then there would be a nice experimental approach to look at food webs in soil, or to distinguish between the organisms that feed on soil organic matter from the organisms that might be involved in eating other organisms. We have developed some approaches to try to quantify both growth and mortality of organisms through 18O water SIP. So it's possible through quantitative real-time PCR to measure the relative abundance of a sequence in a DNA fraction. And eventually, one ends up with the measurements of a gene copy number per nanogram of DNA. And there are at least three different fractions in which you can measure the abundance of a gene sequence in 18O water SIP experiment. And here I'm talking about an 18O water SIP experiment in which only two bands are formed. So we don't allow the incubation to go so long that three bands form, but only two bands form in the 18O SIP experiment. One could measure the gene abundance, shown here in one, in the soil that is used prior to the incubation, so at a time equals zero. This would reflect the number of organisms that are present in soil prior to the incubation. It is possible to measure the gene abundance in the non-labeled DNA retrieved after the incubation, and these would be organisms that survived the incubation but did not grow during the incubation. If they had grown, their DNA would have become labeled. And then finally, there's a third fraction in which you could measure the gene abundance, and that would be in labeled DNA retrieved after incubation, and this DNA would represent organisms that grew during the incubation. And it's then possible to calculate a growth index of different organisms. For instance, one can calculate a growth index by taking the ratios of the relative abundance of a DNA sequence in band number 3, which is the labeled DNA, and divide it by the abundance of a DNA sequence in the DNA that was present prior to the incubation. And so this growth index could be high if the abundance of a sequence is really high in the labeled DNA, but it can also become high if there are not very many of those DNA sequences present prior to the incubation. Imagine a situation where a particular organism comprises 99% of the sequences present at time equals zero, and after incubation comprises 50% of the labeled DNA. On the one hand, you might say, wow, this organism has grown a lot. It comprises 50% of the labeled DNA. Whereas in reality, its abundance has declined over time. So by taking the ratio, it is possible to calculate a growth index of an organism, regardless of how abundant it is at time equals zero. It is also possible to calculate a mortality index. Organisms that are present in the beginning of the incubation, represented here, but then die during the incubation, and as a result are absent in the non-labeled DNA after the incubation, are organisms that have died. And so an organism that is very abundant at first, here in band number 1, but then is absent in band number 2, is an organism that has a high mortality index. So an example of some experiments we have done looking at growth and mortality indexes is we were interested in comparing fungi and bacteria. Using conserved fungal primers and conserved bacterial primers, it is possible to measure the relative abundance of fungal and bacterial sequences in the different DNA fractions. And when we wet up a ponderosa pine forest soil, what we find is that the fungi grow faster than the bacteria. That is, the growth index of the fungi is higher than the growth index of bacteria. We also find that the fungi are better at surviving the incubation. The mortality index of bacteria is higher than the mortality index of fungi as we wet up a ponderosa pine forest soil. So one interpretation of these results is that the bacteria die during a wet up in soil. We know that when we wet up a soil, there's usually a flush of nitrogen and carbon that's released. And this data would suggest that the bacteria are a likely source of that nitrogen and carbon, much more likely than the fungi. We've also tried, or we have compared the impact of ammonia availability in soil on the growth of ammonia oxidizing bacteria and ammonia oxidizing archaea. These are organisms that oxidize ammonia to form nitrite. There are two very different types of organisms that are capable of doing this in soil, bacteria as well as archaea. And there have been lots of questions about how these organisms are different from each other. Are they competing directly with each other, or do they have different niches in soil? And so here we compare a negative control in which we only add 18O water to a treatment in which we add 18O water and ammonia. So here you see three replica tubes to which only 18O water is added. And then you see three replica tubes to which 18O water and, in this experiment, ammonia is added. It is then possible to extract the DNA from these soil samples, spin it in an ultracentrifuge, and separate the labeled DNA from the non-labeled DNA. And the question then becomes, is the growth index of bacteria or archaea higher when you add ammonia to the soil? So in this experiment, we measured ammonium and nitrate concentrations. Here, looking at ammonium and nitrate concentrations prior to the incubation. Ammonium is represented by the closed bars and nitrate concentration represented by the open bars. And then after the incubation is complete, we measure ammonium and nitrate concentrations again. And we find in the control experiment, to which only 18O water is added, that ammonia concentrations increased. Nitrate stayed relatively stable. If we added ammonia to the soil, we see no increase in the ammonia, but we see a dramatic increase in the nitrate concentration, suggesting substantial nitrification activity occurred and was stimulated by the availability of ammonia. If you look at the growth index, so this is now calculated by measuring the abundance of an ammonia oxidizing bacterial gene in labeled DNA, as well as measuring the abundance of the ammonia oxidizing archaeal gene in labeled DNA. What we find is that the archaea represented by the closed bars do not seem to be impacted by an increased availability of ammonium. The growth index doesn't change. However, the ammonia oxidizing bacteria, which are represented here by the open bars, the growth index in the control experiment is lower than the growth index when ammonium is added to soil, suggesting that the ammonia oxidizing bacteria benefited from the increased availability of ammonia in soil. We've also used 18-0 water sip to study the degradation of toluene in soil. We collected soil from an automobile salvage yard, added 48 parts per million toluene to the soil, and saw that if you sterilize the soil, which is represented by the curve here, open circles, that the toluene did not disappear. However, in the live soil represented by the closed circle, we find toluene concentration declines over time. And so we envisioned a very similar experiment as we had done with the study of ammonia oxidizing bacteria in archaea and the availability of ammonium in soil. What we thought we would do is we would take soil to which we only add 18-0 water, and we'd compare it with soil in which we added 18-0 water and toluene. And then by comparing the labeled DNA in the two treatments, we thought the toluene degrading organisms would be present in the labeled DNA here, and they would be absent in the labeled DNA there. So if we could figure out what DNA sequences formed in this labeled DNA band and were absent in that labeled DNA band, then we could identify the toluene degrading organisms in soil. However, we ended up with an unexpected result. Here you are looking at ultracentrifuge tubes taken from soil incubated with 16-0 water right here, and you see that one band forms. We also extracted DNA from soil to which only 18-0 water was added, which you see here on the right, and two bands form. But if we incubated the soil with 18-0 water and toluene, a third band, shown right here, formed, a very thin third band, present in all three tubes. And so what we hypothesized is that the genome of the toluene degrading organisms in soil would be present in that lower third band. Well, the first thing we did is we used conserved bacterial primers, amplified the 16S ribosomal RNA gene from the third labeled DNA band. And what we found is that both by direct sequencing the PCR product, which is the third band extract, as well as by cloning the PCR product, which are these clones right here, that the 16S ribosomal RNA gene was closely related to Rhodococcus jastii RHA1. This is an actinobacteria well known to thrive in relatively dry soils, such as the one we were studying, and it's also well known to be an excellent pollutant degrader, having many different oxygenase genes, and has previously been reported capable of degrading toluene. So we thought that that was a very good sign, that the identity of this organism made a lot of sense. We then went about and tried to isolate a toluene degrading bacteria from the soil, and we were able to do so. And we sequenced the 16S ribosomal RNA gene from this isolate, and it turned out to be Rhodococcus jastii strain RHA1. Here you see two petri dishes. On the left side is a culture which is grown in a toluene atmosphere. On the right side, you see the same isolate now grown in a mineral media, but no toluene is available, and you see the organism does not grow, suggesting that the strain can use toluene as its sole carbon and energy source. And this isolate was capable of degrading toluene in pure culture, So here is toluene concentration on the y-axis. The open circle is a sterilized control, whereas the closed circles show toluene disappearance in live pure cultures of the isolate. And so when we sequenced the 6-nis ribosomal RNA gene of the isolate, it fell right with the sequence obtained from the third band, as well as the clones that we generated, as well as the known 6-nis ribosomal RNA sequence of Rhodococcus jostei RHA1, suggesting indeed that the genome of a toluene degrader is present in that third DNA band. We also used quantitative real-time PCR to measure the abundance of Rhodococcus jostei in our soil over time. And what we find is that if we add toluene to the soil, which is shown by these dark circles, that the abundance of Rhodococcus jostei 6-nis ribosomal RNA sequence increases rapidly over time, whereas if no toluene is added to the soil, the 6-nis ribosomal RNA sequence of Rhodococcus jostei does not increase over time. And so we feel that all of this data together shows that the genome of Rhodococcus jostei is present in that third DNA band, and that Rhodococcus jostei is degrading toluene in our soil. And so the big question becomes, well, why does a third DNA band appear after soil is exposed to toluene? In the beginning of my talk, I suggested to you that the third DNA band appears because organisms can obtain their oxygen atoms from both water and food. And so why would a third DNA band only appear if you expose the soil to toluene and not if the soil is exposed to regular soil organic matter? And what we think is going on is that there are no oxygen atoms in toluene. Rhodococcus jostei is capable of using toluene as its sole carbon and energy source. And so for Rhodococcus jostei to convert toluene into nucleotides, which is what it has to do to grow, it has to incorporate oxygen atoms into the carbon skeleton of toluene. And those oxygen atoms likely come from water. So that the DNA of Rhodococcus jostei is doubly labeled with oxygen atoms because it is using toluene as its sole carbon and energy source. It has no choice but to incorporate extra oxygen atoms from water into its DNA. This is very different from, say, using glucose as your carbon or energy source. Glucose already has many oxygen atoms in it, and it's relatively easy to convert glucose to ribose, sugars, which are part of DNA. You go from glucose to glucose 6-phosphate to ribulose 5-phosphate, and you're on your way to making nucleotides. You do not have to incorporate oxygen atoms from water into the sugars to make this happen. And so if this is true, then one can see some interesting applications of 18-0 water SIB to the study of several environmental challenges. For instance, the degradation of petroleum in the environment. Petroleum consists of many, many different compounds, and it's very difficult to, say, get a crude oil sample that is uniformly labeled with 13 carbon, because there are so many different compounds. But it is possible to combine crude oil with 18-0 water and then study the formation of DNA in that third band. What you see, if you look at crude oil components, is that there's very few oxygen atoms that are part of crude oil components. And so what we suspect would happen if you added crude oil to soil is that, again, a third DNA band would form from organisms that are using crude oil components as their sole carbon and energy source. They have no choice, but they must incorporate oxygen atoms from water in order to form new DNA. And then finally, I'd like to leave you with more speculation. Well, maybe speculation is the wrong word. But one of the big questions in soil is the degradation of cellulose versus degradation of lignin. And people think cellulose decomposes relatively fast, lignin does not. But who degrades cellulose and who degrades lignin in soil? It remains a very big question. Cellulose is made up of glucose subunits. And to go from glucose to DNA components is relatively straightforward. You do not incorporate oxygen from water to form new sugars. But lignin, on the other hand, has lots of aromatic compounds. And when lignin degrades, the results are phenolic compounds. Must an organism that lives off lignin incorporate oxygen atoms from water into its DNA so that organisms that degrade lignin would become more labeled compared to organisms that make their living degrading cellulose? We don't know the answer, but it would be interesting to find out. I'd like to end up with acknowledging some of my graduate students, undergraduate students. So Karen Adair is a PhD student in my lab who provided the data on ammonia oxidizing bacteria and archaea in soil. Steve Blazewicz was an undergraduate in my lab, and now he's a PhD student in Mary Firestone's lab. He helped with the measurements of 18O in soil DNA. Angela Woods is a master's student in my lab that is finishing up right now, and she did the work on toluene degradation. And I'd also like to acknowledge the people who gave me funding to do the research. Thank you. Any questions?
Yep. Thank you very much for this very stimulating. So I was thinking about your suggestion that you could actually, almost at the beginning of your talk, that you could actually use the second band to identify food web.
Right.
Have you thought of the fact that actually the OAT in exchange probably the CO2 in the soil, and that the CO2 in the soil is actually directly taken up the carboxylation reaction by the microbes, so that that could be confounded?
Right, so it is indeed true that carbon dioxide and water can exchange oxygen atoms relatively quickly, and that so another way that one could imagine oxygen atoms to end up in DNA is through carbon fixation by microorganisms in soil. I tend to think that carbon fixation rates in soil are relatively slow. That is, I don't imagine that much of the new DNA formed during a short incubation are from organisms that are fixing carbon from carbon dioxide. That most of the DNA is formed by chemoorganotrophs, organisms that are feeding on soil organic matter in soil.
Yep. And in the trophic level concept, nematodes eating bacteria, etc., if you had higher orders of trophic interactions, think about the connectivity theme of the session, could you help us? Will you get more bands lower down, or will the bands fuse up towards that first band?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, and we don't know the answer. But one would expect that eventually there's got to be a maximum of how much 18O atoms you can incorporate into DNA. But maybe indeed either that third band would widen over time from organisms that are recycling 18O atoms, or maybe a fourth band could possibly form, I don't know. But it'd be really interesting to incorporate a soil sample for, say, 6 months and see what happens. Nobody has done so.
There's no need to worry about having discrete bands, that you could actually just consider depth within the gradient, you know, so that a function of depth within the gradient would be part of the story then.
That is correct. It turns out that it's relatively, you know, people fractionate the contents of these SIP tubes, and there are big debates of what type of mixing occurs as you're fractionating these tubes. But indeed, you can simply take depth within the gradient as an indication of the extent to which the DNA is labeled. The advantage of having discrete bands is that you end up with way fewer samples to analyze, which is important if you're interested in replication and if you're interested in having multiple treatments that be part of the experiment.
Back to that idea of where you're actually seeing that new band and the hypothesis that you actually think there might be, you know, protozoa grazing and that type of thing that's occurring. Have you worked out sort of, you have a conceptual idea here, but to me, of course, it's counterintuitive. You think that that's become more diffuse with time. Of course, you seem to be getting at least potential for more banding there. Would you expect that band again to, you know, get more banded, so to speak, or?
Yeah, so the argument for having discrete bands form is that there are specific oxygen atoms within the DNA that get labeled. So what Riches and Boyer show is that these two oxygen atoms and phosphodiester linkage get labeled through water, and that's just the only way they can get labeled. Whereas these other oxygen atoms only can get labeled through food. So if that is the case, then you can imagine that you would have discrete bands that form. You know, because you couldn't have like a partially labeled molecule. It's either yes, it's labeled from water, or yes, it's labeled from water and food.
questions?
Thank you.